just want to offer a few reflections on metta, or loving kindness, as a strength. You know, metta, this Pali word that many of you are familiar with already, that has a variety of translations. So friendliness, loving kindness, just kindness, open-heartedness, love, however we choose to think about it. So I want to speak about it a little bit as a strength, because often we can underestimate it. So the theme of our weekend is exploring different ways that wisdom and love converge, and what emerges out of that coming together. So one place where they definitely converge in the teachings is the map of the Brahmaviharas, right? So the divine abidings, the expressions of the awakened heart. So the heart, once it's free of grasping and fixation, what's left is not nothingness. It's not a void or a vacuum, but said that what's left are these natural expressions of heart, these dwelling places. The heart abides in love, and when it meets pain or difficulty or suffering in another, compassion naturally arises, as we've been talking about. And when it meets beauty, joy, goodness, appreciation, joy naturally arises. And the balancing factor at the end is this wisdom factor of equanimity that can kind of hold the long-range view that Tim was talking about. It can hold the fluctuations of joy and sorrow, ease and pain, birth and death, holds those opposites, and it lends a strength or a stability to metta. So the wisdom coming together with metta can really be a strength. So equanimity, it's so easy to get a wrong idea of what it feels like or what it is. It's so easy for it to be mistaken for a kind of detached aloofness, right? Untouchable, unsinkable, like we talked about yesterday. So this word I've been playing with is this combination of wisdom and love. So in Pali, wisdom is panya, and loving kindness is metta. So I'm playing with this word, metta panya. Okay? This is my own hybrid creation. But that's how they complete each other, and that's how it becomes, how we can really, I think, experience it as not aloofness, but as strength. Can really feel the two fuse and coming together. So wisdom without love, or lacking love, can just become an ideal or an idea, right? It's so easily can turn into judgment, or just knowledge, like Tim was saying yesterday, become a thought in the head, a good idea, what we know would be best for ourselves or someone else, but it's without that caring, connected openness in the present moment of love. So with that, we can feel, with that wisdom absent of love, love is absent from wisdom, or kind of lagging behind a little bit, it can come across as a kind of rigidity or arrogance, almost. I've got this figured out, right? I've got this, I know this is right. Become a sort of fundamentalist, even in our spiritual practice. I've got this really good thing. And we can feel that subtle separation in that wisdom absent of love. And then love, when it's lacking in wisdom, I mentioned this on the first night, can stay a little bit too small. It can start to feel, we can like and enjoy the pleasantness of care. It can become too affectionate, just limited by what it likes, what feels good, what feels pleasing, what reciprocates, and also what's mine. Right? So we can become limited to just affection. And both of these kind of limitations are necessary steps, like in the deepening of love and the deepening of wisdom. We need a certain clarity, and we also need a certain affection, but we just can't stop there. So I think partly why we how we underestimate metta as a strength is we confuse it with affection, just simple affection or sentimentality or liking. So we can look at that. It was, there may be quite a cultural, I think, bias around this. I was teaching, and there was a monk who had done a lot of training in Asia, some training in the West, and we're speaking kind of behind the scenes, and he made this kind of gruff, in the middle of a discussion, this gruff comment, why do the women always focus on metta? It's like, shh. And so I got to watch, my own heart contracting around that view. So that conditioned view, it's not who he is, his conditioning coming through in that moment. So I got to watch my intolerance of his intolerance. Right? Anyone had that experience lately? Oh, yeah. So I've been calling these little snippets like patriarchal remnants, right? Little PRs, you know? So don't expect, yeah, I'll speak about this a little bit more later, but just outmoded conditioning coming forward. Coming forward and feeling that my own contraction around someone else's view is also a separation. Right? That I've got it right, he's got it wrong. So we have endless opportunities to practice this, but there's a pervasive idea that still that metta is limited. That our love is not a strength, that it's something to kind of maybe fall back on. So let's explore together, and you can definitely take this into your own practice, ways in which it can really show up and we can experience it as a strength. So Tim and I were at a retreat earlier this year with Ajahn Suchito, a monk, British monk in the Thai forest tradition, and someone asked him, how does metta come together with anatta, this selflessness? How do you experience the coming together of loving kindness and selflessness? And he said something like, this is a paraphrase, so anatta is realizing the impermanence of the boundary, the self boundary. It's realizing that it's not ultimately substantial, that there isn't anything solid there, it's not real. And the movement of love or metta grows stronger and stronger and sort of pools up behind any boundary, right? And will eventually overtake it, move through it, reach beyond it. Because the movement of metta, when it's freed from just this limited affection, it has this boundless quality, right? That doesn't have a limit. It just keeps building up, building up, building up, moving forward like water, pooling up and then rushing over, So in the text, it's this immeasurable, boundless quality of heart. So I think often we experience it in its limited form, and we don't get the appreciation for what this natural quality, when developed, really has this outward, expansive, strong, boundless quality. So I've been doing loving kindness practice with my son in the evenings, who's 5, his own simple version of it, before he goes to bed. In some ways, as an antidote to fear, because he's right now afraid of ghosts. So we're doing a little bit of metta in the evening. So starting with his own body, going out to, you know, animals that he really likes in the neighborhood, going out to teachers he loves, going out to friends who are getting ready for bed at the same time, all of that. And I keep expanding the boundary, right? Pushing the boundary out, out, out. And he said on more than one occasion, "Mama, why would I go beyond the neighborhood? Why would I go beyond this neighborhood? It makes no sense." It's like, I don't know these people, right? And so there's a bit of fear, you know? He has enough of a sense of independent identity right now that to some degree the unknown is threatening. So why would I go beyond the neighborhood? So as we keep going and we keep, stopping, recognizing fear, and continuing to expand that, you know, night after night. Now, do you want to go a little bit further? No? Okay. Now a little bit further. And by the end, often, he's more than willing to extend it to every frog, every squirrel, you know, every tree. It's like, no, we can't leave out this. We can't leave out that. And one night he said, okay, even the robbers, right? Even the bad guys, right? Because it's very much bad guy, good guy right now. Not just with kids, right? So eventually, as we're staying with it, and not that he, of course, he's not free from all time, but for all time, but in those moments, the natural movement of metta is like, what else can I include? Right? Pulls up behind a boundary and says, oh, too painful to keep that out. What else can I include? Let me include the robbers, them, the bad guys, right? So, what?
Ghosts,
exactly. Yeah, so right now on his bedroom door, we have a letter to the ghosts. Because it doesn't work, wisdom without love does not work, to just point out there aren't ghosts. Anyone tried that with kids? It does not work. You have to be like, okay, we have to relate. So we're writing letters to the ghosts and stating our preferences, and they're up on the door. So, yeah. So creativity, wisdom, love, creativity. Panya metta, metta panya. But that natural movement of moving beyond a boundary. So if we come at it from an intellectual place, I think Tim was saying, could be, I should be more loving. I know what I need to do right now. I know what I should do, but I don't feel it. Right? So often in practice, we have these moments, like with intention and many people I speak to in groups and practice interviews and on retreat. I've seen this pattern again and again in myself. I know where this leads. I know the outcome of this. I know kind of the cost to my own heart and mind. And I'm still in it. Right? I'm still kind of subject to this pattern. Why is this still here? Anyone had that? Who's been practicing for a while? Why is this still here? I've worked with this. So wisdom and love coming together, when we can see it, but we're not completely free of it. One teacher who said 85% of the practice is seeing our constructions, that construction process. So I'll offer just a few kind of ways that I've been kind of relating to this in my own practice. And one is the gesture of bowing to our illusions. Bowing to our illusions. And this is where love is a little bit in the foreground of wisdom, right? So this gesture of a bow. I know some people connect with this and some people don't. It's not so much, it's not an abdication of authority or good judgment or our own wisdom or deference. For me, the bow is, this head does not know everything. Right? It's almost the head bowing to the heart. Right? This head does not know everything. And it's also our illusions have tremendous strength, if we haven't noticed, and tenacity. And there's a way in which our subtle resistance of them is keeping them going, right? So there's, in some ways, it's a gesture of respect. I may not like this. This may be acutely uncomfortable. I may be impatient with this, but here it is again, okay? So it's a bow. And so the heart can kind of come forward in that. And it doesn't mean we need to be the victim of our illusions. We can continue to look at them, continue to work with them in creative ways, continue to really see their mechanics. But we can also respect that they have a place. They're in place for a reason, usually some kind of survival reason. And they've kept us in some degree of safety. So, when we do this, it allows us more and more to open further to what might be difficult. If we're always keeping the ghosts right outside the door, it can be difficult to really know them fully. So it takes love to open that door. So this is Ajahn Suchito. He talks about this as meeting the howling dog. Right? So he says, probably every one of us who's practiced meditation has experienced the howling dog syndrome. It's like you have something within you that is whining, and hearing it, you think, I'll shut that out and get on with the practice. It's like having a dog howling in the basement. So you close the door and move up to the next floor to get away from all that racket. But the howling gets louder. Maybe it's about the difficult state of your body or the unresolved feeling you have about somebody you're living with. You think, these aren't spiritual matters, so cut them out. Move up a level. So you move up another floor. The howling gets louder. Eventually you get up to the roof, but the howling is still disturbing your peace of mind. And then there's nowhere else to go. Got to turn around and go all the way down and meet the howling dog and make friends with it. Quite a bit of our practice is rather like this, coming to terms, meeting our craving, one's pain, one's grief, one's sense of self. So we'll meet these moments in practice. Where did someone say to me just the other day, I know everything that I should be doing to feel better, and I'm not doing any of it, right? I'm eating mac and cheese, staying up too late, watching TV, and getting lost in worry and anxiety and obsessive thinking, and I see this playing out, and I'm not able to choose otherwise. Right? So this is the nature of the afflicted mind. Like, affliction is such a good word. It's like we're afflicted. The mind is caught. So it takes a tremendous amount of love at that point to say, this is how it is right now. I have the deepest aspirations for freedom. I can feel that potential in myself. And right now it's like this. It takes a tremendous amount of care, but we can start to feel the strength of kindness in that, manifesting as patience, as perseverance. I'm not giving up on this. Right? I'm not giving up on myself. I'm not going to struggle with myself, but I'm not giving up on myself. So we pet the howling dog. We bow to our illusions. And in that way, the kind of affectionate sort of love that is more kind of provisional and transactional. Like, I'll stay in this as long as it feels good, as long as I'm acting the way that I think I should act, as long as good things are arising, it starts to move into that unconditional friendliness, unconditional openness. Okay, let me see this. This is from Tsogni Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher. He's talking about working with his own patterns that were coming up as, this seems so innocent, but coming up as a fear of bridges, right? Walking over high bridges. So anyway, he was saying this is how he was working with it. After this recognition of my pattern, I realized something even more important. I was being unkind to my pattern. I wanted to get rid of it, to just break through it right away without taking any time to listen to it or learn from it. See, patterns take a while to build up and it can take a while to see them, understand them, and loosen the knots that form them. Working with our patterns requires great kindness and gentleness, the same quality parents apply when they comfort children. Sometimes. Okay. All right. So. All right. So we're rather familiar, actually, to this. We may not experience it all the time, but we're rather familiar with this kind of gentle, yielding quality of metta. Right? So, but as it builds up, and other in different texts and sometimes different lineages, kindness and especially compassion has personifications that are quite fierce, right? There's like a fierce protectiveness of compassion. It can be gentle and yielding. The circumstances or the terrain is such, but when there's a sense that harm is being done, the direction, the movement of compassion is one of swift ferocity and protectiveness, right? So we can feel this movement of metta as well as it moves into compassion. And the way that I've worked with this is a practice I've been using lately called full stop practice. And lived in India for a while, and just short story. We're helping some women who spoke Tamil learn English, and they had been studying, you know, the British system of English, and so in that system, in British English, a period is often called a full stop, right? Full stop. So we would have these wonderful sessions of writing, and then I would say, okay, full stop, and they'd put the period down. And I started to work with my own thoughts and inclinations in a similar way. And because there was so much kind of kindness in this interchange, it allowed a certain attitude of kindness to come into the own way that I was relating to my own mental patterning, right? So certain thoughts or streams that I've known so well, am I doing it right? Is this right? What do they think? You know, oh, she made a stern face. What does that mean? You know, is that, oh, I shouldn't have said that. did I express that well? So familiar, right? The tone is so familiar. I wonder if so-and-so might need that, you know, just, you know, solving the world's problems as we're sitting here. And so I would experiment with this full stop, feeling that sentence, that thought, that like first inclination down that road, and then practicing, okay, full stop, gentle. Not gonna go down that road. Not going to do that. Much like if we were in an interaction with someone where there was a lot of, you know, someone was unleashing a verbal tirade at us, the movement of metta in that moment would not often be okay, you know? In one sense, it would be okay, this is happening right now, but it would also, there's a fierce protectiveness of our own hearts. It would be okay, full stop. And we can't make them stop. We could say, I'm not going down this road right now. Yeah, thank you, I hear you, but I don't want, I'm not gonna be the recipient of this right now, right? So we can do that. We can say a firm no with kindness. We can get a feel for that. Very foreign to me for a long time, but we can say, sometimes it's called the holy no, right? The holy no. Feels there's something valuable here. It's worth protecting. And no, I love you, but I'm not going that way right now, right? So it's firm, it's fierce, it's protected. It's not blaming. Just saying. In the Metta Sutta, as many of you know, there's this beautiful phrase that gets quoted all the time. It's just as a mother would protect with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Right? And we get that, a glimpse of that ferocity, I think of a mother in the wild, you know, and her, like a bear, baby cub. That is not a gentle, yielding relationship when there's danger. That is, there's fierce protectiveness in that, right? It's the strongest kind of instinctual force there is. So, in some ways, I think we need to be reintroduced to that sense of active, fierce compassion without blame. And it's a difficult line, right? We can easily tip into blame and arrogance, but that protectiveness of heart. And I know Ajahn Jeff was here last month, right? And we've been doing a more than a year study group with a small group on the Metta Sutta, going line by line through it. And we got to that part about just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. And reading his translation and his interpretation of that has been completely sort of blasting open my understanding of that piece of the sutta. And I've been practicing with that. And his phrasing of that, just as a mother would risk her life for her child, her only child, even so should one cultivate a limitless heart with regard to all beings. So it's not, and this is just his perspective, but it's not so much cherishing every being as though they were our own child, but ways protecting and cultivating our own heart with that same ferocity that we would protect our own child, right? It's that same feeling of cultivation, kind of protection, and nurturing with that same strength, but towards our own heart. So with the idea that our heart can kind of grow wide with qualities like kindness, compassion, appreciation, and that these are healthy, these are worth cultivating, and these are also strengths, right? That when we're experiencing ill will, blame, the qualities Tim spoke about this morning, that it's not that this is actually weakening us. This is like a toxin in our mind, in our system. So with that same kind of strength of heart, can we have that same devotion to our own cultivation that we would to a child, right? Not in a patronizing relationship. I presented this to my young adult group. They're like, that sounds patronizing. Just as a mother would protect, you know, what if I don't need protection, right? But I think it's speaking to the same quality of the strength of metta and a deep commitment to non-harming. So when we are harming ourselves, when we feel that inclination, that same self-beratement, self-doubt, self-recrimination, it's a full stop. When we feel that from others, it's a full stop. Right? So we can explore that in our own way. So, as always, we're experimenting creatively with different ways to hold both of these, to hold the howling dog when that's present, but to equally hold our own deepest aspiration, right? To hold both of those, this deep potential for freedom, this almost like evolutionary impulse for awakening, for development, that part of us, that deep longing for freedom, you know, part of us that knows that we're wider than this, we're bigger than this, and that it's possible, but that everything has a shadow, right? So in our own personal individuality, we can't expect that there won't be a shadow. In our societal situation, we can't expect that there won't be a howling dog shadow emerging, right? How do we treat that? In our beautiful Buddhist traditions, we can't expect that there isn't going to be a shadow, right? Otherwise, it's just blind idealism, right? So evidence of shadows everywhere, right? So, yeah, patriarchal remnants, bits of shadow, you know, abuses of power, all sorts of blind spots, so we can watch, how are we with that? Do we try to skirt around and just keep going? Just head down, let's keep going? Or do we see, oh, here's the shadow, here it is. It's part of the development of any being, any system, any living thing. So there's a beautiful photo back there in the interview room. I'm sure a lot of you have seen it, of the eclipse last year, 2017. And it's been really fun to practice this weekend. There's all these new images, right, that I don't get to see very often. But this picture of the eclipse, the full eclipse last year when the sun was completely covered for those few minutes. And to know that this too is part of nature. Sometimes the light is completely in shadow, and still there are these bright beams coming out from all around it, right? Still. So it's never one or the other. It's never complete light without a shadow. It's never complete shadow without a light. And to really be able to hold both of these is the deepest wisdom and the deepest kindness, you know, our humanity alongside our divinity, if you want to call it that, our integrity. So we can bow to all of that. And the saying on the photo over there is in the room is sunshine, a gift, due notice.